Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. If the Democratic race for a presidential nominee seemed high energy last year, well, we are in 2020 now, the actual election year, and so the campaigns really kick in the afterburners. Just 1 month from now, the state of Iowa will hold its caucuses, the first test of what voters really want versus what they'll tell pollsters. 33 days left for the candidates to stand out or to survive, so what's it like on the ground in Iowa now? This hour on Point, we'll go to Iowa to feel the energy amongst Iowans and inside the campaigns. And you can join us. Iowans, you be our eyes and ears on the ground. And Iowan Democrats in particular, have you decided who you'll caucus for? And if so, why? What are the candidates saying that appeals to you? Or are you still undecided? And for voters in the rest of the nation, will the result out of Iowa next month have any impact on your pick? Join us anytime on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining me today from Des Moines is Rachel Stassenberger, politics editor for the Des Moines Register. Rachel, it's great to have you.
Great being here. Thanks for having me.
And also with us from Iowa City is James Lynch. He covers politics and state government for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. James, welcome to you as well.
Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to both of you. And my it gets off to quite a start in Iowa. I'm seeing that just today, that Vice President Joe Biden, Senator Amy Klobuchar, and Senator Bernie Sanders are going to be holding multiple events each just today all over Iowa, everywhere from Sioux City to Grinnell and beyond. So, Rachel, I mean, is it just sort of a breakneck pace from here on out?
It certainly is. We have 87 events so far for January already scheduled with the presidential candidates. But frankly, it has been 2020 in Iowa since, I don't know, about 2018 towards the end. We've had thousands of events. We've been doing polling. The candidates can't seem to get enough of Iowa. And Iowans are showing up for these events and have been for more than a year now. So we're in the final stretch, but we've been running this marathon for quite a while.
More than a year now. So, James, on the one hand, it makes me think that that's a recipe for voter fatigue, getting to know all the candidates as well as they have the opportunity to do. Or are we seeing now that there's just that month and a day before the caucuses that perhaps a lot of Iowans are they getting closer to deciding? Are they tuning in for the first time?
Meghna, you would think there would be voter fatigue, but it doesn't seem to be showing up. I mean, if you look at the crowds that are turning out for these candidates, over the holidays, a lot of people, you know, were free from work, so they were showing up at these candidate events, some of them for the first time seeing a candidate. And yeah, I think they're getting closer to deciding. If you ask people, their short lists are getting shorter. You know, it's not five or six. It's now down to maybe a couple candidates that they were, you know, trying to decide between. So that process is continuing and probably will accelerate over the next 30 days as people really get down to that final choice, some of them on caucus night.
Mm. Well, so Rachel, let's just get the obvious question out of the way here. At this point in time, what does the polling tell us about who might be sort of eking out ahead here in Iowa? We've been seeing that, Vice President Biden, Senator Sanders, Senator Warren, and Mayor Pete Buttigieg are kind of, they were neck and neck. I mean, is that meaningful at this point in time in the race?
Well, our last poll, we do the Iowa poll and have been doing it since 1943. Our last poll was in November, and so we'll have to look for newer polling numbers to make a definite choice, because as James said, a lot does change in these final weeks. But it has been those top four in some various configurations. You know, early on, Biden was leading. In September, Warren was leading. And back in November, Buttigieg was leading. And so we've seen a lot of jumping back and forth. And then there's Sanders, who hasn't necessarily led a poll here in Iowa, but has a really strong base. And so you'd have to look at those top four. But frankly, there's still time for breakout moments. You know, Amy Klobuchar has had some really good debate appearances and has started to rise in some of those Iowa polls. You'll look at a Cory Booker, who has a significant ground game here in Iowa. And so there's a lot of uncertainty, even though these Iowans have been making their decisions for a while. A lot of them are yet undecided. In our last poll, I think it was about 30% who said, I'm not changing my mind on my top choice. I am locked in. And so that leaves a big chunk who could still pick a new favorite.
Mm. Well, Rachel, I was looking at some analysis of the polling that we've seen so far from Iowa. The analysis was from Henry Enten on CNN, and he was kind of picking on the paucity of Iowa polls and saying, actually, the one that you referenced didn't use live interviews or cell phones. So like, he was basically saying, we can't really tell at all if Amy Klobuchar's kind of low-ish numbers are meaningful. I mean, she could surge ahead when caucus day comes.
I wouldn't think he necessarily was questioning the Iowa poll that we do. There are different polls that have come out that may have some methodological problems in them. But there have not been many polls in December, which has, you know, given people a lot of room to speculate on what's really going on the ground. So it'll be interesting once we get new numbers, and those will be pretty significant.
Okay, so James, I've been hearing this phrase that Iowans vote early but decide late. Does that mean that if you are a Cory Booker or an Amy Klobuchar, and I was going to say if you're a Joaquin Castro, but I can't say that anymore since he just dropped out of the race this morning, that perhaps there's a lot of hope to be had in the next 30 or so days?
Certainly. And as Rachel referenced, we've seen Klomentum, Amy Klobuchar's okay. support seems to be growing. A lot of enthusiasm for her. People keep asking, when is Cory Booker going to break out? So I guess that hope is alive for all of these candidates because Iowans tend to wait until close to caucus day to make up their minds. You know, they may have one or two candidates they're considering, but they – you know, they're not going to – part of it might be they just don't want to tell us at this point. You know, they want to sort of hold that until the end and let their friends and neighbors know on caucus night who it is they're supporting. So it keeps that hope alive for candidates who are sort of on the bubble, are hoping for a late surge that will carry them, you know, into – viability on caucus night.
Okay. Well, let's listen to a little bit of a moment from an event where Mayor Pete Buttigieg was in Indianola, Iowa, just before Christmas. And actually, actor Kevin Costner stumped alongside Buttigieg at this event. And Costner was saying that he believes Pete Buttigieg can bring the country together.
When Pete speaks of unity, it's the kind of unity I've been waiting and hoping to hear about.
Field of Dreams star Kevin Costner saying Buttigieg is the answer to the nation's divisions.
I see Pete as having that kind of courage.
So that tape courtesy of WHO-TV. Let's also listen to Bernie Sanders, Senator Sanders. He threw a New Year's bash of sorts in Des Moines the other night, and he said that 2020 would be one of the most pivotal years in the history of the United States. And here's some of the ways that Sanders said 2020 will be special.
2020 will be a year in which we end corruption in Washington. And a year in which we begin the process of creating a government based on the principles of love and compassion.
Senator Bernie Sanders in Des Moines the other night. So, James, tell me, is one of the most recent rallies or events you've been able to go to?
I was at a Joe Biden event just a week ago in sort of a rural community in Iowa. There were maybe 100, 200 people there, sort of a late afternoon rally, which was a pretty good turnout for a community that size. There was good enthusiasm there. Biden, you know, got a good reception. He seemed happy with the turnout and the enthusiasm he felt from the crowd. And that's typical of a lot of these events. They're getting good numbers there. At that event, it was very interesting because it was right before Christmas. There were a lot of people there who were visiting, folks who had roots in Iowa but were coming back for the holidays and won't be participating in the caucuses, but were very interested in seeing the candidates because if they live in Oregon or if they live in Minnesota or wherever, they might not see candidates until a year from now. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, they're not seeing the campaign. So it was very interesting to talk to them and get their perspective on the Iowa caucus campaign from a distance.
Right. So let me ask you, because, I mean, obviously in the national media, we just did the same thing here. We hear snippets of what happens at these events in Iowa, whereas the actual, you know, rally or town hall or house party is a much longer and more intimate affair. So what are the kinds of questions or concerns that Iowan voters who go to these events, what are they looking for in the candidates?
Well,
one
I don't
of the
think
things that we've seen.
Go ahead.
Go ahead,
sorry,
Rachel.
James.
No, go ahead, Rachel.
One of the things we've seen at the Register, we've several times during the cycle have tracked all the questions that people have been asking these Democratic candidates and seen that there's two issues that are very much on their minds and they have held steady throughout the cycle. And those are health care, which you've obviously seen, mm-hmm. you know, the candidates talk about on the debate stage, as well as climate change. You know, here in Iowa, there was severe spring flooding, which sort of brought this to the fore of a lot of these campaigns. And then there's a third theme that has been pretty consistent, which is any Democrat that I'm going to support has to beat Trump. And so there are some compromises people are making internally to think about who can beat Trump. You know, whether it's my ideal candidate or someone else, I want Trump gone. And so those are the three things that have been very consistent. And you haven't really seen much wavering off of that. You know, impeachment comes up every now and then, for instance. Some of the foreign policy issues come up every now and then. But those three core themes have been very, very solid in Iowa Democrats' minds.
Okay. Well, James, I'm going to want to hear from you about the same question when we come back from a quick break. We're talking about the fact that we are just 1 month and 1 day away from the Iowa caucuses, the first real test of Democratic presidential hopefuls. And if you're in Iowa, we want to hear from you. If you're an Iowan Democrat, do you know who you're going to vote for or maybe who you're leaning towards? And if you're a voter elsewhere in the country, do you put a lot of stock in what Iowa will have to say in a month and a day from now? This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the fact that we're just a month away from the Iowa caucuses and what that might mean for the remaining presidential hopefuls in the Democratic field who are going to be spending a lot of time in the state over the next 30 or so days. I'm joined today by Rachel Stassenberger. She is politics editor for the Des Moines Register. She's with us from Des Moines, Iowa. James Lynch is also with us. He covers politics and state government for the Cedar Rapids Gazette, and he joins us from Iowa City. City. And James, before I turn to you, I just want to play an ad that Vice President Biden's campaign has been running in Iowa. It's an ad called Laughed At, which begins with a video of President Trump being laughed at by other world leaders at the UN General Assembly. And here is some of that Biden ad.
The world sees Trump for what he is: insincere, ill-informed, corrupt, dangerously incompetent, and incapable, in my view, of world leadership. And if we give Donald Trump four more years, we'll have a great deal of difficulty, if ever, being able to recover America's standing in the world and our capacity to bring nations together.
That's an ad from Vice President Joe Biden's campaign in Iowa. Now, James, Rachel had talked to us about sort of four key issues that keep coming up in the minds and questions of Iowa voters. I want to ask you specifically about Democratic voters, I should say, the issue of their folks looking for someone who they believe can beat Donald Trump. Is this something that folks at Biden rallies have been asking him about?
Yeah, the electability issue is a big issue, and it's hard to get people to define what electability means to them. But beating Trump, obviously, is what they're talking about. And the argument for whichever candidate they're talking about is that, you know, Joe Biden is the candidate who can beat Donald Trump, or Tom Steyer is the one who can do it. And they have various reasons. Certainly, Biden is banking a lot. It seems like he's banking a lot on this idea that he can go head to head with Donald Trump, that he has the, I guess, the gravitas to defeat Trump. And then kind of a secondary argument is that he can reach across the aisle and capture the votes of a lot of independents or swing voters, and even some Republicans who may not like Donald Trump's presidency.
Well, I believe Vice President Biden just recently said, Rachel, that he recently said that he would even consider a Republican as a running mate should he become the Democratic nominee.
That's right. He did say that. And I think it's part of that outreach that James was just talking about to people who may not be, you know, your typical purist Democrats, who may be looking for this unity that you've seen all the candidates talk about. And maybe one of the ways to create that unity is to get a Republican on the ticket. Now, I don't know that Biden will actually do that. He's also floated some names of Democrats the type of people that he may want as vice president. But obviously, he's a former vice president. So vice presidential decisions for him, more than almost anyone else in this race, are really key. And it's a role that he's thought a lot about.
Mm. But James, let me ask you, since you said just before the end of 2019, you did go to a Biden event. Is he taking any questions at all from Iowans about Hunter Biden, about his son and Ukraine?
I haven't heard that.
Okay.
Certainly, Republicans are talking about that.
Yeah.
And I think when you talk to Democrats, some of them will mention that it could be, you know, sort of baggage in the general election campaign. But I haven't heard anybody asking him, you know, in a Q&A about Hunter Biden and what effect that might have on the campaign. One thing, Meghna, I would say when we talk about the questions that Iowans are asking, Rachel certainly ticked off that list. I would add one: guns. I hear a lot of questions about gun control, what they're going to do about gun violence, what the candidates want to do about gun violence. The other thing is, and it's sort of a parochial issue to some degree, but questions about trade, because Iowa has been impacted, especially agricultural trade. People are asking about that. It's certainly not unique to Iowa, but it certainly is an issue that affects a lot of Iowans. And they're asking, you know, what's your trade policy going to be? What are you going to do about tariffs? That's on the minds of a lot of Iowans.
Yeah. Well, let's go to our callers here briefly if we can, because a lot of Iowans want to join us. Let's go to Amanda, who's calling from Diagonal, Iowa. You're on the air, Amanda.
Hi.
Go ahead, Amanda.
Yeah, so I'm going to be caucusing for Bernie for the second year in a row. I'm not an Iowa native, but Bernie, his actions continually speak louder than his words. I feel like if I wanted to stay with the status quo of where the government is at, I would stick with Joe Biden. But Pete's also been exciting. I know that lots of people are supporting him because they think he can unify the House, but I mean, it's time to take a break from the status quo, and we need something new to catch all the people that are falling through the cracks in the current setup of government.
Mm. Amanda, so this is really interesting. You're going to caucus for Senator Sanders, but did I hear you say that you think Pete Buttigieg is also exciting? Because they're two very different kinds of candidates, aren't they?
Two very different kind of candidates, and I will go back to what one of the reporter from Des Moines was saying, journalist from Des Moines was saying earlier, that Buttigieg has the pulling the Republicans and the Democrats. I think that could be a testament in the race to see who wins. But I mean, Bernie has just proven himself time and time again. I would go with Buttigieg or Warren if I was worried about the Republicans getting pulled back in too.
Well, Amanda, thank you so much for your call. Rachel Stassenberger, what do you think about that?
I think that's interesting, and it does underscore the point that, you know, Democrats are really very interested in beating Trump in this race. And we've also seen, you know, this call certainly from Sanders, but also from Warren. You know, her signature line is big structural change of something that's not just, you know, what Democrats would say is repairing the damage that they think Trump has done, but going beyond that to really shake up government in a big way. And so you heard that from Amanda, and you hear that from a lot of Iowans, which is, you know, that people want big change. You know, Trump certainly brought about big change for the country. While Democrats don't like it, they do like the idea of a radical reshaping of government.
Mm. Well, James, since Amanda brought up Pete Buttigieg as well, let me ask you, I mean, he is all in on Iowa, right? He's got a very extensive ground game across the state to the point where I've been reading that he talks about, actually, as you both have already mentioned on the show here, trying to pull in what he calls future former Republicans. And he's even really put a lot of effort, I believe, in counties that once went for President Obama, but then voted for President Trump. I mean, how effective do you think he might be in that?
It's hard to say at this point, yeah. And it's hard to say really until we have a nominee, I think. If he's the nominee, I think he can make inroads, especially with independent voters and who supported Trump in 2016 and maybe having buyer's remorse. Whether he can attract Republicans, that's going to be harder. I mean, our party identity is pretty baked in, and there aren't many people who are going to cross the line to vote for a candidate. But if he can make inroads with what we sometimes call swing voters, if you can pick up 2% of them, you know, an extra 2%, that's going to help. Joe Biden was telling me last week that any Republican voters you pick up, especially in states like Iowa, Minnesota, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, in those key states in the electoral college battleground, if you can pick up 1% or 2% of Republicans in those states, it's going to make a huge difference in the end.
Huh. Well, James and Rachel, stand by for just a moment, because I want to turn now to Rachel Payne Caulfield. She also joins us from Des Moines. She's a professor of political science at Drake University. Professor Caulfield, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what are you seeing right now sort of in this the 30-ish days ahead in the road to Iowa? Does this caucus feel like are there patterns that we've seen before in Iowa caucuses, or does this race feel quite different?
Well, both of those things are true at the same time, okay. I think.
I like to give people options.
Yeah, exactly. So on one hand, you know, the Washington Post had a great opinion piece about the so-called Iowa cyclone effect and the fact that this last month before the caucuses can witness just tremendous change for some candidates. So, you know, in 2004, this was John Kerry and John Edwards, both of whom increased by more than 20% support in the final week before the caucuses. So this is the famous Iowans decide late phenomenon, right? There's a lot of movement that can take place. Mike Huckabee, in the last month of the campaign in 2008, he increased 20 points. Down Rick Santorum in 2012, and although Ted Cruz and Donald Trump stayed relatively stable in 2016, Marco Rubio had a pretty remarkable final week and ended up increasing from 11% to 23%. So any poll numbers that we're referencing right now could change on a dime. You've referenced the fact that we don't have a lot of polling out of Iowa. And to some extent, an over-obsession with the polls really obscures this late-breaking momentum that can take place in Iowa in a way that you don't see it in a lot of other states.
Interesting. So, you know, we touched on the how sort of in the national media and maybe in a national sense, there's been a lot of discussion about a pull between the so-called progressive wing of the Democratic Party and the more centrist wing. I can't even call it centrist wing. The centrist aspects of the Democratic Party.
Right.
Is that how is that tension being played out in Iowa, or is that definition sort of too pedestrian for what's actually happening on the ground there?
Well, if you look at the national dialogue about this election, people are talking about it as a very stark kind of two-lane race. You have the moderate lane and you have the progressive lane. And so, for example, you know, over the weekend, I saw a story about the most recent fundraising numbers, and they compared the combined total of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and the combined total of Buttigieg and Biden. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren raised more money, and they therefore concluded that the energy in the party is squarely behind the progressive wing. And I think that national narrative obscures a lot of the more fine-tooth judgments that are happening on the ground in Iowa among voters who are actually having a chance to see these candidates. I don't think all of them are thinking in terms of two lanes. I think they're often thinking in terms of who these people are, what their interactions with them have been, what these events look like, what kind of energy they get in the room. And if you just simply look at second choices, and again, I don't want to put too much stock into polls at this point in the race, but if you just look at some of the polling, what you see is a lot of overlap between these two lanes. So, for example, the November Iowa poll found that among Buttigieg supporters, 28% of them list Warren as their second choice.
Yeah.
Right. So there's some crossover there. Even in a national poll among Biden supporters, Sanders is the top second choice. So there is an opportunity here for a lot of voters to kind of bring the best aspects of these two different quote-unquote lanes together in their thinking about candidates. And I think we need to be careful, therefore, in over-essentializing what this race is about for voters.
That is absolutely fascinating. So Rachel Stassenberger, what do you think the sort of – I mean, we heard that in our caller, too, who said she's going to caucus for Sanders but was really excited about Pete Buttigieg as well. I mean, Rachel, what do you think that tells us?
Again, I think it goes back to some of the fundamentals that my fellow Rachel just talked about. And I also think it's really important to bear in mind that these are caucuses. They're not primaries, which means essentially that the registered Democrats showing up on February 3rd may have two bites of the apple. They come in, they vote for their favorite, and then some people will not get 15% of the room in that first vote. And then there's what's called a realignment. And they get to vote again with that first – the people who didn't get 15% dropped out. And so somebody may look be in a room where, you know, let's say they were all for Amy Klobuchar. She doesn't make that 15%. They look around and, hey, there's Elizabeth Warren, who is going to be viable on the second ballot. And so they may go in for Elizabeth Warren. Now, you may say, you know, in the more simplistic view – Amy Klobuchar is a moderate and Elizabeth Warren is a radical, and how could you possibly want both of them? Well, Iowans do have that kind of thinking where they think through their choices, not just in those simplistic views. They have a much more nuanced view of it, in part because they've seen all these candidates and hung out with them. And, you know, the old saying is, I won't vote for you in Iowa unless you've been in my living room not once but twice. A lot of them really have experienced that.
Yeah. Well, so, James, let me add something that that actually I read in the Des Moines Register, which might even add some more texture to what will happen next month here, because I'm seeing that this year the Iowa Democratic Party is going to publish, after the caucuses, multiple raw vote totals and the delegate numbers from caucus night, and that they haven't done that before. Is that right?
That's right. And it's going to be very interesting to the, I suppose, the news media and political junkies. I'm not sure if the interest extends much beyond that. There are a lot of people, especially in Iowa, who get really caught up in this and have for years and said both the delegate totals and the raw vote numbers should be released so everybody, you know, has a complete picture. I think it's going to be one of those things, you know, that people talk about afterwards and analyze. What impact it's going to have, I really don't know.
Let's just speculate for just one little moment here. Could it be possible that we would have might see an outcome where the delegate numbers go to one candidate, but those raw vote totals might go to another candidate?
Yep.
I think that's possible.
This is Rachel Caulfield. I think it's possible that we actually have somebody who wins in first vote raw vote totals, somebody who wins in realignment final vote raw vote totals, and then somebody else who potentially wins in delegates.
In our piece that we published, I think it was last month, you know, we said that there could be multiple winners of the caucuses. You know, often certainly people want the delegates, and that is the ultimate number that comes out of Iowa. But Iowa being first really is about momentum. Mm-hmm. And so you may have multiple candidates claiming that they have the momentum based on these different numbers. And maybe, in fact, organizing around these different numbers, because you can claim a win even if you ultimately don't get the most delegates.
Right.
And so, you know, we've been looking forward to that and sort of trying to scenarioize, you know, how this all could work out and which candidates would be in which positions and all that kind of stuff. And so it goes beyond just sort of the political geeks that are fascinated with this. You know, who wins Iowa has been important for since 1972. And so people will be looking at all those different numbers and watching to what they mean for the momentum going on to New Hampshire, to Nevada, to South Carolina. And so it's going to be a really fun time.
So that's exactly why I think it's fascinating that those multiple sets of numbers are going to come out of Iowa in February, because to Rachel, to your point, we're talking to the nation here, and we're going to hear from callers about what they think the significance of the Iowa caucuses will be on February 3rd. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about the Iowa caucuses this hour because they happen in a month and a day. It's the first real test of Democratic presidential hopefuls in the 2020 presidential election. Now, let's listen for a moment to a campaign ad that Senator Elizabeth Warren has been running in Iowa. The ad is called Deeply Divided. It has aired 1,248 times at least, 1,248 times in Iowa between December 23rd, 2019 and December 31st, 2019, so in just an 8-day period. And in this ad and on the stump, Senator Warren has been focusing on corruption, promising that one of her first tasks, should she be elected president, will be to pass the biggest anti-corruption bill since the 1970s.
Our country is deeply divided, but people across this country, Republicans, Independents, and Democrats, agree that our top priority has to be fighting corruption in Washington. I'm not doing big dollar fundraisers. I'm not selling ambassadorships to donors. I'm not cozying up to super PACs.
Senator Elizabeth Warren in a campaign ad that's run a lot in Iowa. Let's go to Laurel, who's calling from Waterloo, Iowa. Laurel, you're on the air.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Okay. So first of all, I am just super excited for caucus night. It'll be my third, and the energy in the room is just amazing. And to hear everybody talking, and it's so true what Rachel was saying, like you go in there and you want one candidate, but something might change you or that first vote might get to you and then you switch. And it's just, it's a very exciting time. And I hope that everybody goes to caucus because it also does a really good job of emphasizing local government, which is actually an issue that I feel like I look towards in a candidate, somebody that's wanting to support local government, where we can see the most impact on a personal level. So anyways, and right now, I guess I should say that I am a Yang Gang member.
Okay.
And Kamala Harris still is a bumper sticker on the back of my van. Joe Biden is a lawn sign for my husband, who is a libertarian, but still supporting Joe Biden. And it's just, it's great. Iowa is great because it's all about the party and supporting each other.
Okay. Well, Laurel, thank you so much for your call. So Laurel there being originally a Harris supporter, now a member, a self-described member of the Yang Gang, and her husband is pulling for Joe Biden here. Let's go to Tom, who's calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi. Hi, you guys.
Go ahead, Tom.
Hi.
Hello. Hi. I was a Kamala Harris volunteer, door knocking, call banks, whole thing. And when she folded, I am lost on who to support that I think is similar to her. And I really wanted a woman in the White House, and I really thought it would be a good idea to have a Black person in the White House again. And
well, there are several candidates remaining in the race who at least fit half of those criteria, Tom.
Correct. And I think the I think most Democrats are, as you guys said, are wanting to select the person that they think is most likely to beat Trump. And to me, that means beating him. A lot of it is beating him in the debates, and which I do not think is a particularly presidential quality, being able to do the quick repartee that they presidents are balanced and do a lot of research before they create a bill or sign a bill.
Tom, let me just jump in here and ask you one more quick question, and then I definitely want to hear what our panelists have to say about this. But what was it about that Senator Harris had as a presidential candidate that you say you can't find in the remaining Democrats in the field?
Yeah, the fighter, her history as a prosecutor, and I thought she could really tear down Trump's walls and his deflection and the lies.
But Tom, couldn't you potentially also be describing Senator Amy Klobuchar with those same phrases?
Kind of, and she's certainly one of the people I am looking at. I like it that she's from the Midwest. I think that might be a plus. My wife and my son are both huge Warren fans, but she's just not quite centrist enough for me.
Gotcha. Well, Tom, I'm going to take it back from you there because you've actually said a lot of stuff that I want to hear from our panelists, their take on. So, Tom from Cedar Rapids, thank you so much. And by the way, I forgot to reintroduce my panel. I'm joined today by Rachel Stassenberger. She's politics editor for the Des Moines Register. Rachel Payne Caulfield joins us. She's professor of political science at Drake University. And James Lynch is also with us. He covers politics and state government for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. And James, let me turn back to you since you've been patiently waiting there. Two former Harris supporters there. And I was actually, I'm glad they called in because I've been curious about where Harris voters might go. And it sounds like they're not quite sure yet.
Well, I think this illustrates how complicated this choice is for a lot of Iowa Democrats. They, you know, land on a candidate, and then, as in her case, Harris's case, she drops out of the race, and then it's like, okay, where do I go from there? And sometimes it doesn't seem like it's a straight line for these candidates. You think, who is most like Kamala Harris? And that may not be where they're going at all. We heard from Tom that he was looking for a woman and a person of color. Now, does that mean he'll end up supporting, say, Amy Klobuchar or Cory Booker, or does he end up, you know, he talked about somebody not being centrist enough for him. He could end up supporting Joe Biden, who is neither a woman nor a person of color. It's complicated for Iowa caucus participants.
That's going to be the new lawn sign. Iowa 2020, it's complicated. Yeah. Rachel Payne Caulfield, what do you think about that, about the sort of conundrum or the surfeit of choice, let's put it that way, that former Harris supporters have?
Well, I think one of the important things that a lot of people miss about Iowa, because it's a caucus rather than a primary. So most people around the country will go to a primary and they will have the person they support and they will go into a booth and they will push a button or they will pull a lever or they will, you know, whatever it is they do, and then they will walk out and that's the end of their voting process. In Iowa, the caucus is an interactive exercise in persuasion, discussion, conversation, priority setting, consensus building. And so that interactive nature is really important. It's entirely possible that Tom will go into his caucus uncertain of exactly who he wants to support. He may settle on a candidate, but he may, during the course of the caucus itself, he may have a chance to go to his friends, family, neighbors, you know, other Iowa Democrats in his precinct, and he may say, here are my concerns. Tell me why your candidate is the best candidate. Those are the conversations that are happening in that room in each and every precinct caucus across the state of Iowa. And that's why a sophisticated campaign in Iowa is not just about field work. It's not just about advertising. It's not just about collecting as much money and holding big rallies as you can. It's about actually interacting with activists on the ground, because those activists are the people who are going to go into the caucus room and they're going to be your on the ground voice for the campaign. They're going to have to express, why is this candidate better? Why do I think that Amy Klobuchar is the right person? Why do I think that Andrew Yang is going to solve problems in a way that other candidates can't? Right? Those conversations have to happen. And that is an incredibly rare thing, to Laurel's point. This is an incredibly rare thing. There are very few venues in American life where we're having these conversations. And so a caucus is a really rare political conversation among the community.
Well, let's spend a little bit more time here talking about Senator Amy Klobuchar, because we mentioned earlier Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who, as he campaigns through Iowa, is talking about his Midwestern roots. Obviously, he's not the only one doing that. Senator Klobuchar is emphasizing that as well. And just before the end of 2019, she visited all 99 counties in Iowa. And so here is an ad that Senator Klobuchar's campaign has been running. And the ad begins by saying, if we don't stop Donald Trump this time, shame on us. And then Senator Klobuchar also says her Midwest roots will help her bind the nation's wounds.
Americans deserve a president who has their back, who isn't afraid to take on powerful forces, who has a record of bringing people together, and most importantly, who gets things done. I know what it takes to win in the Midwest. It's not flyover country to me. It's home.
An ad there from Senator Amy Klobuchar's campaign. Let's go to Jane, who's calling from Algona, Iowa. Jane, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm glad to be on the air to talk about Amy Klobuchar, because she's the candidate that I'm going to support in the caucus.
And what is it about the senator that's drawing your support?
Well, I, of course, being from a neighboring state, I have been able to kind of follow her career in the Senate and from the very beginning. And I know that she has been able to get bills passed that are, have support across the aisle. And that is so important at this time when that's so rare. And I appreciate that. She is tough, I would say, and yet she's funny, And I think that helps her when she's working with others across the aisle. And she's a woman, and I'm 77 years old, and I would love to see a woman win the White House before I die.
Well, Jane, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Mike, who's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm a supporter of Elizabeth Warren, and the reason is I think that the situation, both economically and politically in our country right now, is really dire. It's really a low point for our country in both those aspects. And the situation is not really unlike the period of the Great Depression or right after. Mm-hmm. And at that time, America elected Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he brought big systemic changes, both to politics and to the economy. And he was very popular, and he was reelected repeatedly. And a third reason for Elizabeth Warren, and that is she is really a great, great communicator. To listen to her speak about the situation in America and what she would propose needs to be done about it, to me is reminiscent of what it must have been like to listen to FDR in those fireside chats.
Really?
She's very plain spoken and very straightforward, and I think a vast majority of America would agree with her.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for your call. Let's get one more in here. Let's go to Ann, who's calling from Cedar Rapids. Ann, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for squeezing me in. I am an ardent supporter of Cory Booker. Cory is a moderate. He's enthusiastic and energetic, and he's very personable. He has experience, and I think he would be the one to unite and enthuse those independent voters to get them to come out on caucus night and on voting night in November. Mm-hmm. I think he's the man for the job with his experience, his energy, his moderate, his attitude.
Wow. Well, Anne, thank you so much for your call. So, Rachel, James, and Rachel, I have to say, I am so impressed with Iowa voters. And I will say they're also On Point listeners who called in and sharing their considered opinions about these various candidates. I mean, we're hearing Jane saying she wants someone who can actually get Washington to work together, and who's a woman. Mike calling from that big systemic change that Elizabeth Warren talks about, and Anne wanting to pass the torch to a younger moderate. Really fascinating. So I'm going to close this conversation kind of skating on thin ice here, given how thoughtful those voters were, because there is now more than ever the question of whether or not Iowa should be first. I mean, and Joaquin Castro was talking about that, and of course he's no longer in the race. So James, let me just start with you. How do Iowans hear that question? Because as the Democratic Party becomes more racially diverse, in the rest of the country, people are wondering, should Iowa be first?
I think Iowans, there may be some Iowans who agree with Julian Castro that Iowa shouldn't be first, that it has an outsized influence. But overall, I think Iowans think they do a good job of being first. And I think what gets lost in this discussion sometimes is that being first involves a lot of responsibility and an awful lot of work for the party and for the party activists that I'm not sure other states realize or are prepared to undertake if they were, you know, tabbed to go first.
Yeah. And James, I just want to stop 1 second and say thank you for correcting me, because I am really embarrassed that I got Julian Castro confused with his twin brother.
Well, they're identical twins, so it's easy to do.
But they're not identical on the radio. I'm still warming up here for 2020. So thank you for that very gracious and subtle Iowa nice correction there. But Rachel Payne Caulfield, let me ask you the same question. Should Iowa be first?
I think there are a lot of things that Iowa offers as the first state in the process that other states would have a hard time mimicking. Among them, we have tremendous ideological diversity, and that's true on both sides of the aisle. It's a state that's easy to campaign in. There's not a major media market. There's a very civically engaged population. And what that means is it's not just the candidates who enter a race with big money or big name recognition who are able to gain a foothold in Iowa. So you can go door to door. You can meet with voters, and Iowans expect that, and they welcome that. And so little known candidates have a better chance in Iowa. I think that kind of leveling of the playing field is incredibly valuable to our presidential selection process.
And Rachel Stassenberger, you got 30 seconds left to – I'm going to guess that you're going to say yes, Iowa should still be
to defend Iowa. I mean, I think my colleagues have brought up some of the good points defending Iowa. I would also say one of the other points that people bring up is Barack Obama. You know, he was the first African-American president of this country, and he really got his start in Iowa, which, as you say, is a very white state, but that is not determinative of who the voters will go for.
Well, Rachel Stassenberger, politics editor for the Des Moines Register, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And James Lynch, who covers politics and state government for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. James, it was great to have you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Rachel Payne Caulfield, professor of political science at Drake University. A pleasure to have you, Professor Caulfield. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.